This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the Senate pushes a lawsuit challenging President Bush, and Bill Cosby says the Washington Post series on black men is too positive. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more, Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Brown University. He joins us from member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. From our Chicago bureau, Laura Washington. She's a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. And Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, joins us from our New York bureau. All right, folks, let's take a look at what we're seeing from Arlen Specter, highly respected Republican. And he is looking to push legislation that would clear the way for Congress to challenge George Bush's signing statements. We should note that these are statements that revise the right, or reserve the right, I should say, to revise, interpret, or disregard law on the basis of national security and constitutional grounds. The American Bar Association estimated that George Bush has signed close to 800 of these statutes, more than any other president combined. Laura Washington, when we hear this and see that a powerful Republican like Arlen Specter is taking the president to task, what does this say, if anything?
Well, politically, it says that George Bush is, as we know, been very vulnerable in recent months. And this is not the first challenge. You remember the challenge that his own party has issued against him about the subpoena, the search of William Jefferson's office. And there was a huge pushback, even in his own party, against the Justice Department for what they saw as illegal and unfair search. This is another example of that. I think the troubling issue here is the volume of signing statements. As has been pointed out in the past, every president has exercised this right. But George Bush has signed close to 800 of these in comparison with, as I understand from the Bar Association study, more than any other previous president combined. So his people say not to worry here. He's simply concerned about particular technicalities in some of these laws, that this does not mean that he's going to disobey these laws. But when you have this many examples of statements where he's basically saying, I don't have to follow the law, it can be very troubling.
Michael Myers, critics have suggested that this president, perhaps more than any other in history, has tried to circumvent the law and do it cloaked in oft times the name of fighting terrorism. Can this be fuel for the fire?
Well, I now understand why it's only been one presidential veto during Bush's administration. If you can issue 800 signing statements by saying that I disagree with the law, why you don't need to veto it? This is a no-brainer, it seems to me. We don't need the American Bar Association to tell us what we should have learned in civics. And we did not learn anything about signing statements. The executive's duty is to faithfully execute and enforce the law. Now, the problem comes, of course, when a law is vague or ambiguous. But if the law in the president's judgment is unconstitutional, then the president should veto it. If he hates the law, then he should veto it. But he can't pick and choose which laws he's going to enforce. And that's why the Congress is so up in arms, so to speak, because it's congressional prerogative. So I think this is bullheaded. But interesting enough, Mr. Specter, who you say is respected, Mr. Specter let somebody on the United States Supreme Court who endorsed the notion, Mr. Alito, who endorsed the notion of signing statements. Interesting, isn't it?
Interesting indeed. And Glenn, here's what's interesting to me. The idea that Specter and other Republicans are making this push that would really suggest that the president is acting unconstitutionally so close to an election. This cannot be good in one respect for Republicans who often were in lockstep with this president. I'm sure there will be the spin doctors who say that we're just making sure that we get this thing right. But it doesn't speak well when you're this close to a midterm election.
That's right. And there are political implications. And Republicans are distancing themselves from Bush in anticipation of the possibility that he will be a negative drag. I don't think that's Specter's motivation. Specter has been making this point for some time now about congressional prerogative versus imperial presidency. You remember the hearings when the Attorney General Gonzalez came up there to try to explain what was going on with the warrantless wiretapping? Specter was fierce in those hearings in demanding that the administration be more forthcoming. Remember the brouhaha over the president's assertion that the Congress has very clear direction regarding the ending of torture and establishing the policy that torture is not something that the U.S. would be engaged in. The president equivocated in response to the John McCain and other initiative on that regard. Many members of the Congress were furious about the president's equivocation when they had very clearly indicated what they wanted to have done. So I see this as a part of the, you know, complaining about Dick Cheney's secret energy task force, advising him about energy policy, about disagreements with the administration over the prosecution of the war and the lack of accountability in the administration for failures in the prosecution of the war, and a kind of high-handed attitude in the White House that the imperial presidency is what's required for the United States during a time of war when these people have messed up their responsibilities and then have claimed that they're not accountable to anybody under some kind of constitutional protection. There's a larger subtext here of conflict between Congress and the White House that Specter is emblematic of.
All right, let's move our attention to a gathering this week of potential 2008 contenders for the White House on the Democratic side as they convened with the Democratic Leadership Council, a council that some years back with Dick Gephardt, Bill Clinton, and others really moved the Democratic Party to the center. They took it away from the liberal wing, if you will, and now these candidates are having to speak before this council and talk about where they want to take this party. Michael Myers, it's always interesting to see Democrats talk about where they want to take their party.
And to understand that they have everybody under the tent of Democrat. The Democrat Leadership Council, as far as I'm concerned, is a joke. It is not liberal, and I think the Democratic Party is supposed to stand for liberal ideas, not centrist ideas. I regard them as wishy-washy, in the middle, and I am so tired of Democrats. You call them John Kerry, call them John Edwards, call them the new people who are now running for president, including Hillary Clinton, coming before the microphones and saying, I have a plan. What happened to John Kerry's plan? What happened to John Edwards' plan about poverty? Now Hillary Clinton, another voice, has a plan. She has a plan for health care. I thought she had a plan for health care when Bill Clinton was president. She wants to make college more affordable. Who doesn't? They want to secure retirement and security. Who doesn't? But speak truth to power. How do you do all this with deficit spending and then with the price tag of the war in Iraq? And Hillary will not talk about withdrawing the troops from Iraq. She's not serious. You can talk about gas prices and rising prices and high taxes, but what's the plan to bring the troops home, Hillary?
Laura, here's what's interesting when I think about the DLC, and that is the question, as many people suggest, save Bill Clinton and his masterful means of politicking, if you will. Many saw this as the recent death of the Democratic Party, taking it, as Michael Myers said, from what for years had been a stronghold on the liberal side to a more centrist, benign view of what to do society or societal means and the need to find a real clear message.
Well, you mentioned Bill Clinton, you said the word masterful, and I think that's where the disconnect is here. Bill Clinton was a masterful communicator, a masterful politician. He was able to take that centrist position, which is what got him elected, and use it effectively in his presidency. There has not been a leading Democrat of any stripe who's been able to do that since then. And part of it is that they don't have a clear message. I think the messenger, you don't have to have a Bill Clinton if you've got an agenda. And as Michael points out, they really haven't had a clear, compelling agenda. And I think they also have, as he points out with Hillary Clinton, they have a real security issue. Democrats have just never been as credible. Maybe this is unfair to them, but they've just never been as credible on national security issues, on war-related issues, as the Republicans. And they still aren't coming out with any kind of a credible message on Iraq. And until they do, they have no hopes of taking back the White House.
Glenn, what does this say for the liberal side of the Democratic Party? Certainly over the course of the last 8 to 10 years, that has been really minimized and beat into a corner, particularly those of the most liberal bent have had very little to say when you talk about moving this party nationally.
Yeah,
and we should note that includes most African Americans under the Democratic banner.
Indeed, it does. And the liberal left wing of the Democratic Party has been, I mean, not just marginalized, they've been demonized very effectively by the rhetoric of the conservatives. I mean, liberal is now a dirty word. I mean, you're a left winger if you're in favor of increasing the, you know, social welfare budget. That makes you a left winger now, and that's supposed to be a bad word. And a lot of that is rhetorical marginalization. But, you know, the liberals did not make the transition very well from the 1960s and 70s into the contemporary era of Republican-dominated American politics. Bill Clinton and the DLC are the only Democrats to have gotten themselves elected president of the United States in the last 30 years. You have to go back to Jimmy Carter to find a Democrat who actually got elected prior to Bill Clinton. That centrist triangulating strategy was perhaps not pretty, and it didn't make all of us feel very well, but it was the most effective strategy the Democrats have managed to fashion in the modern American political era. And now we're in another position of transition, and these guys need an ideology. They need a framework. They need something that they stand for. And you can't just invent that off the top of your head. As far as the war is concerned, I agree with Michael Myers. It's a fiasco, and Democrats, out of responsibility to the country as well as to themselves, ought to be very clear about it and not be equivocating.
It seems also that, Michael Myers, the Democrats need their own Karl Rove. Not since the days of Ron Brown have we seen a Democrat be able to galvanize this party, get them on a one-track thought, and move forward.
Well, the Democrats might need Ron Brown, but he's dead in the grave, but they certainly don't need a Karl Rove. What the Democrats need is some intelligence, some guts, some courage, and stop running away from the guts and courage it requires to say to the American people what you really believe and how to get us out of this fiasco in Iraq and how to get us out of this fiasco of deficit spending in the United States. People are sick and tired of double-talking politicians. Why doesn't Hillary know that? Why, Hillary? Why?
All right, let's get to someone who hasn't had any problem saying what he believes, and that is Bill Cosby, who is a part of a Path to Success, a forum for young African-American men sponsored by the Kaiser Family Foundation over last week. He talked about an interesting series being run in the Washington Post. It's called Being a Black Man, and it portrays all of the issues, problems, concerns, etc., of black men today. Cosby lambasted the series, suggesting that it was too positive, if you will. Among the findings in the Washington Post, it said 8 out of 10 black men said they're satisfied with their lives today, and 6 out of 10 reported that it was a good time, quote, to be a black man in the United States, end quote. Cosby suggested that this was simply wrong, period. Glenn Lowry, when you hear this, and again, Mr. Cosby, like it or love it, has had the fortitude and wherewithal to stand oftentimes in gale wind criticism to say what he believes and to quite frankly say what many people say behind closed doors and who do not have the courage to say in a public forum.
Yeah, that's correct. And as I've said here on this program before, I don't think there's any point in wasting time beating up on Bill Cosby for telling the truth. I think there are some questions about whether or not his rhetorical strategy is effective at changing anything on the ground, but that's another matter. It's ironical. Typically, the complaint is that the press is insufficiently attentive to what is good in black America and overemphasizes the negative. Cosby is saying there wasn't enough emphasis on the negative. Well, of course, his campaign is to point out that there are serious problems in black society and they must be grappled with first by black people before anybody else. And to that end, the Washington Post, as their reporter, the African-American Stephen Holmes, says, their balance, their reporting, the wide range of experience of African-Americans doesn't fit his strategy. But if I were at a newspaper and I were going to be doing a series of articles on African-American men, surely I would want to do something more than talk about prisons, about children without fathers, about failure in school and drugs and public health and all the rest. I would want to try to present the whole picture, which is all I thought that the Post was trying to do. So I think that Cosby is right about one thing. There are serious problems in black America. He's wrong about one thing. They're not only black people's problems. They are American people's problems, and they're not going to be solved by, you know, changing values and attitudes in the black community without changing the way schools work, the way jobs are available, et cetera, et cetera.
We should note that Philip Bennett, the managing editor of the Washington Post, suggested that he thought that Bill Cosby was confusing their ongoing coverage of issues affecting African Americans in the Washington region, and that the idea that the next round of profiles of individuals in the series would be a more all-encompassing. But the series has been...
I don't believe that for a second. Look, everybody plays the fool sometimes, and Bill Cosby is just overacting, in my judgment. I've read the Washington Post profile. You know, it's racial profiling. That's what it is, through anecdotes. There's a different perspective. The perspective of the problems of or besetting black males in America versus the problem of black males in America. Bill Cosby is obviously of the school that black males present a problem in America, that they are a problem. It's sort of like the City University of New York and their black so-called black male initiative. What they really are complaining about is that black males, in their judgment, lack initiative. Yeah. This is this is a racial characteristic and a racial arrogance on the part of journalists in particular, including the Washington Post, which rivals only the New York Paternalistic Times in terms of their racial paternalism. And I got to give Laura some time.
Yeah, you got to give Laura some time. And a shout out to the main ingredient for Everybody Plays a Fool, for those who thought you were clever enough to bring that up. Yeah, all right, Laura, with less than a minute, go.
Washington Post is not going to solve our problems. You know, it's fine if they want to cover the black community. These are splashy series that every American newspaper does. They come and they go. They don't solve any problems. They may illuminate some problems. But I think the important thing that Cosby has done is he's gotten the conversation going. Maybe the rhetoric is not appropriate for some people. Maybe the forums are not necessarily appropriate for some people. But he's got the stuff out there on the table because of his national stature, because of the power of his personal stature. And we can continue to have the conversation. Washington Post would have done anything without Cosby's comments from two years ago. And I think that if we don't have this conversation, both in the community and nationally, we're never going to make any progress.
But who gets invited to this conference, Kaiser Foundation?
Well, yeah, that's the other thing.
There was not even a real conversation, a real debate. Don't just put the fools and the clowns up there to racial.
Right.
To racial
they racial should be inviting us.
American black.
They should. Well, right. What about inviting young black men, for example? That's who they're talking about.
All right, well, we'll have to find out who, in fact, was in the audience and get a better representation of the palace before we beat them up. I did receive an invitation, though, I should say. All right, that means, but maybe that speaks to fools being invited. Maybe that speaks to fools being invited. All right, thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Next up on News and Notes, knowing how to decipher restaurant menus could be the difference between staying svelte and derailing your diet, and a world-famous musician introduces teens to the joys of the blues.